Well, here we are. Again. About every 7 days, ain't it? In the book of Luke, again. About every 7 days. We're going to finish up chapter 22 this morning. And we'll like two chapters. I think the way it's going to play out will be about the middle of March or toward the end of March or something like that when we get through. I don't know how long we've been here. It doesn't seem like long, but it's been a while. I'm going to bring you our text to begin with this morning, Luke chapter 22, starting in verse 63 through the end of the chapter. Verse 63 says, "And the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him. And when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, saying, Prophesy, who is it that smote thee? And many other things blasphemously spake they against him. And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, Are you the Christ? Tell us. And he said to them, If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then said they all, Art thou then the Son of God? He said unto them, You say that I am. And they said, What need have we of further witness? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth. This morning we're going to look at these verses. And I don't know if you were like me or not, but over the years, you know, I read through the back end of all the gospel books, and they talk about the crucifixion of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, but from about the time he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane until he's on the cross, he seems like he's going here and there and being drugged back and forth here and there, and I've always kind of known the pieces, and I thought I kind of knew the order, but I never sat down and just wrote it out. So you see a chart there at the bottom of the first page of where Jesus went. You see, first of all, they carry him to the house of Annas, the high priest, and actually that's back in verse 54 of last week's text. It says, Then they took him and led him and brought him into the high priest's house. And he goes from there to the Jewish council and to Caiaphas, and that's what we saw in verse 66 that I just got through reading. And then he goes from there to Pilate, which you'll see that in the first verse of chapter 23. They carry him to Pilate. And then they carry him from Pilate to Herod. And then from Herod back to Pilate. And then from there to the cross. Now we're going to look at that a little bit later in a little bit more depth. But it's a lot of it the next several weeks, actually. But the first thing I want to do is talk about Jewish courts and the rules that Jewish courts had to observe and to abide by and the procedures that they went through. And I've got several things listed there. You can see them. And we're going to go through them in a hurry. We're not going to talk much about them. But as I read through these, I want you to think about our own judicial system and our own government and our own courts and see how many of these things you see glimpses of or some strong indications that our courts have the same thing. And there's quite a few of them, actually. And these are based or on a principle, at least from Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 18 to 20, that the governing of the people and the courts would be given to make sure they did not distort justice. Says in those verses in Deuteronomy. And the governing body was called the Sanhedrin, and it was a different size body, council in different towns, depending on how big a town was. But the biggest one was in Jerusalem, and it was made up of 70 people, 71 including the high priest. And it was always an odd number of members of this council so that you never would have a tie. Okay, we have that same idea in our Senate, in our own country. The Supreme Court has the odd number of people in our country. The accused, you see, there had a right to counsel. He had a right to bring witnesses. He had a right to bring evidence that was on his behalf. And he had a right to a public trial in daylight hours. All right, the accused could not be convicted without at least two reliable witnesses against him. Now, a key word there is the word reliable. They didn't just take anyone for a witness. A false witness would suffer the same punishment that the accused would have received if convicted on false testimony. I think we ought to have that, personally. All right? In our country, all a person has to do just to mess somebody up is to sue them for something or accuse them of something. And it may not be true, but that person is out several thousand dollars to defend themselves. And no repercussions. No repercussions. Don't get me started on that. I've been down that road. The person giving the testimony that condemned a man would throw the first stone. If someone was condemned to death, the person who was the witness that condemned them was to throw the first stone to kill them. The death penalty could not be carried out until 3 days after the sentence. Now, that's not 30 years after. It's 3 days after. But for them, that was a wait. 3 days was a wait. Now, why was it 3 days? It was so that that interval, the intervening 3 days there, could be given by the council to fasting and prayer and the people as well, because you didn't want to just take lightly taking a man's life. And after, and waiting to see if there's more evidence that might come forth. On the third day, the council voted again to affirm the conviction. A council could reverse a guilty plea, but it could never reverse an innocent vote. As a matter of fact, when a person was acquitted, they were released immediately. The council could never bring charges against someone. So the council, even though if they thought someone was guilty, it couldn't be them that brought the charges. They could only receive the charges. Voting in the council was done from the youngest to the oldest to prevent undue pressure upon the younger members. That's a wise thing, I think. Women could not vote on the assumption that they would not be able to carry out the first stone. Casting the first stone. And it's not the idea that the stone was too heavy. It's just that they wouldn't have the stomach to kill somebody with a big rock. All right? I think women are different nowadays, aren't they, Mike? He walled his eyes over at Carol, I saw. Children could not be witnesses because of their immaturity. Another wise move. The court sessions could not be held at night. Mentally insane persons could not be a witness, or a people of unreliable character. And even in our courts, that's always an issue, or sometimes can be, because if someone is known to be a bearer of lies, that's going to be brought out. If he's trying to be a witness in the court, the opposition is going to bring that out, that he's a liar, has a history of lying. And the accused's own testimony was never sufficient to condemn him by himself. If I said, okay, I confess, I committed this crime, I killed this person, they would not convict me on my confession. All right, it had to be two witnesses. All right, we get to the next part, and from what I have read, this is the way it was worded, that great care was taken, and this is not the blank, but great care was taken in this system to show mercy to the accused, right? And I think that's poor wording myself. I think, and here's, this is my words that's in the blank, great care was taken to prevent injustices, all right? You can go back up and look at all of those things and ask yourself, is this procedure, this requirement here to show mercy or to prevent an injustice? And I would think you would say pretty clearly that most of them are there to prevent injustice. When the 70 guys vote, from the youngest to the oldest, the youngest guy is voting first so that he doesn't, it's not intimidated by some of the older members' previous vote for guilty. Or that has nothing to do with mercy. It has to do with an injustice might be done. The need for, and another thing, the need for mercy implies guilt. Doesn't it? It does. An innocent person, and we're not talking about in general a person needing mercy. We all need mercy in a general sense. But we're talking about a specific thing. If I were to be charged with a crime of stealing and robbing the bank, and I didn't rob the bank, I didn't do it, and you were to tell me, you come to bail me out of jail and whatever, and I'm there, and they say, well, maybe the judge will be merciful to you. You know, my answer would be, I don't need mercy. I am innocent. What I need is justice to be done in this particular instance. All right? And I think that's kind of misleading when we say that they're given there to emphasize mercy. Not necessarily. Mercy, if you need mercy, it's because you're guilty of something. Okay. Now, when we look at the, kind of keep your eye on the chart there. Here's some other thoughts that come into play. The high priest was appointed for life. And we have, in our court system, we have a similar situation with that with our Supreme Court justices that are appointed for life. And the high priest, for several years, had been a guy named Annas, A-N-N-A-S. And when the Romans took over, just for whatever reason, I don't know the reason, it's kind of an arbitrary thing that maybe just them showing the Jews that they were in charge. And they told Annas, you've got to retire, you've got to quit. You've got to step down, somebody else is going to take your place. And knowing how the Jews particularly liked that, I'm sure they didn't like that at all. I'm sure it just ate at them. But it was a fight that they were not, thought was not worth fighting. And so Annas stepped aside, and his son-in-law, Caiaphas, became high priest. And matter of fact, the priesthood generally stayed in that family for years. So, you know, it was not like Annas was gone. He still had influence in the system of government there. But Caiaphas was, as far as the Romans were concerned, was the high priest. But in the background, Anna still has a tremendous amount of influence on their judicial system. So when you read in the New Testament, talk about the high priest, you have to determine if that's talking about Annas or if it's talking about Caiaphas in the Gospels account. And that sometimes that's hard to do. It's hard to do if you do the cross references, trying to harmonize all of these events from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John of Christ's trials. That issue comes up. Is that, or when they say high priest, is this Annas they're talking about, or is it Caiaphas? And it's not too difficult to work that out, but you have to listen, pay attention to it. Only Luke, you see it on the chart, includes the visit to Herod. That's only found in the book of Luke. So, And Pilate is on both sides of him. He's at Pilate's before he goes to Herod, and he's at back at Pilate after he's at Herod. So when you read, for instance, in the book of John, who has probably the lengthiest passage of Scripture dealing with Jesus before Herod, I mean before Pilate, excuse me, before Pilate, you have to determine, well, at what point in there was there, is there a break that he went to Herod and came back? All right, and that's a little difficult to determine too. But I think from our text today, or for actually next week, that that trip from Pilate to Herod took place pretty early. The first trip he was at Pilate's, he wasn't there long. And we'll look at that next week, so we're not going to talk about it right now. But that is something that has to be determined. Now, I think that this, when back there in verse 54, it says they led him, they take him from the garden, Judas betrays him with a kiss, they take Jesus, and they carry him to the house of the high priest, and it's, I believe, in John or one of the other Gospels, it names Annas as the person there. And I think what they are doing, the Jews are doing, is trying to get all their ducks in a row, because they know they have a lot of these procedures they have to follow. And they can't have this council and this Jewish trial at night. But they want to have it as soon as daybreak comes. As soon as that sun peeps up a little bit over the horizon, they want to have this trial and this court session. Why is that? Because they've depended on everybody else being asleep, barely getting up, getting breakfast ready and everything, and they're at their business. So during the night, the prior night, they are trying to get all their ducks in a row, get all their witnesses to come and know what they're going to do, so when daybreak comes, they can go in there and boom, 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 they've got it took care of before anyone really knows what's going on, and they have technically obeyed their rules of no night trials. Fits right in, doesn't it? Except we wouldn't. All right, so that's kind of what the background is of all this. Now, you notice that I've on the title of the message, I've got the court is in session, and then in the fine print, you can read, the kangaroo court is in session. And so the next three or four points here are going to be dealing with kangaroo courts. And here's the first one. Kangaroo courts tend to sink the viewing public to a new low standard of moral conduct. All right, now let's read these verses. Jesus has been brought to Annas, and he's there at the high priest's house. And it talks about these soldiers or these security people, whoever they are, begin to strike him, and they blindfold him so that he can't see, and then they take turns hitting him, and he's got to guess who struck him. Who struck you? You know everything. You can foretell the future, and you're all divine and all this stuff. Tell me who hit you, and they slap it. Now, this reminds me of a little game that we used to play when I was a kid. My dad taught me this little game. And some of you may have played it yourself, I don't know, but take a hand towel and pop it. All right. My dad used to sneak up behind my mom, she's washing dishes, and pop her on the butt or pop her on the leg or something, you know. And he learned somewhere along the way, and you know, if y'all do this or not, but you take the towel and you do it like this to roll it up so it wouldn't be flaring out. And he would dip about the bottom 3 or 4 inches in the water, get it wet. So that makes it a little heavier, and it stays tight, you know. And then, you know, pow. And so he would mess with her, you know, and aggravate her. And I guarantee she could hold her own. He was a man, so he, you know, might be getting the upper hand. He was always popping at your butt or your legs. Well, she'd get tired of it, she'd start popping at his head or his shoulders or whatever. When she was ready for it to quit, it quit. All right? Anyway, one year, we never weren't big on birthdays, but one year, my dad let us have a bunking party. where we'd bite three or four of our, we call it bunking, like you sleep on a bunk. Okay, now that maybe is not pronounced exactly right, but a bunking party. I'd invite three or four of my buddies over, and they'd spend the night with me. And I'm sure at my dad's suggestion, we played this game. Except one person would lean over on the couch on his knees, hide his eyes. The other three or four guys would be back here with a towel. And one of them would pop, and he'd have to guess who did it. And he'd stay there until he guessed. And when he guessed, he got up, and that person got down there, and so you go through. Now, you know, there was one guy at that party that if I was really telling you the truth, he was only there because he was my cousin. He was my age, but there is something, and he, you know, this is when we're 8 or 10 years old, but there's something about him that kids just didn't like him. You know, he was obnoxious. I've been trying to think for a week of the way, a word to describe him, but, you know, obnoxious is a word perhaps, you know, just always doing something, you know. And people just, you know, got weary of it. And in hindsight, I look back and see my dad was present when we was playing this little game. And here's why my dad was present. Because I can see a little game like this getting out of hand in a hurry. And 8 or 10 year old boys don't have the maturity to recognize it's getting out of hand. And if my cousin had been down there, and he couldn't guess after three or four times, he could give a joke a lot better than he could take it. And sooner or later, probably sooner, if he wasn't guessing, he'd get frustrated, he might get mad, he might start crying, or, you know, who knows what. And my dad was there not just for him, but for any of us, because we would have piled it on. We're not going to show any mercy to somebody. If you can't guess, the rules are you got to guess. If you're there 20 pops, then that's just too bad. Well, that's not the way my dad would have looked at it. In hindsight, I can see that my dad was there to see that this thing didn't get out of hand. Now, we all grew up. Kind of grew up. I have to confess, we've played that game at our house with Mark and Daniel and Susan. She scratches and pinches. Whatever it takes. But we ought to have grown up. Right? Now here's some guys in our text. Grown men. And they ain't grown up. They blindfolded a guy who is innocent until proven guilty, supposedly. And they're hitting him with their fist or they're slapping him across the face and they're saying, tell us who hit you. Why are they doing that? I'll tell you one reason they're doing it. It's because they recognize a kangaroo court when they see one. They know what's going on. They know that in this courtroom, people are really not following the law. That's the reason they're meeting in the middle of the night to start with. This kangaroo court is a farce, and they know it. And because it's a farce, they begin to act like it's a farce. Let me give you a couple of illustrations of how that I've seen this played out. When I was in school, teenager in high school, our school had, I don't know, three or four kids that were mentally handicapped. And back then, you know, we used the word retarded, and it wasn't a derogatory word. I don't remember it it being viewed that way, but those are the words that we use. So there's three or four kids that way. And, you know, they can carry on a conversation, they can do a lot of things, but it's obvious they're challenged mentally. And, you know, kids are mean, kids are cruel. And kids make fun of them. But they didn't make fun of them in front of the teachers, generally. But one day in study hall, the study hall teacher, it wasn't a teacher, what do they call those? Monitor? Not a monitor. What?
Babysitter.
Babysitter, as good as any. The guy that's going to keep order in the study hall, make sure nothing gets out of hand, he's there, and he's the coach, the football coach. Now, back when I was in school, football coaches had to teach a subject, too, all right? But they're usually, their teaching of the subject was, you know, about like five-year-old kids, you know. You get them talking about a ball game, forget history. That's just the way it was. And they didn't care about whatever subject they taught. They just really wanted to coach. Anyway, he was watching the study hall. And one of these kids was there. And I don't know what happened. I don't remember what happened. I don't remember exactly what the coach said. But he said something in front of the whole study hall people, class, that was derogatory and mocking of this kid. It wasn't just in your face, but everybody in that class knew, you know, what happened. All right? In 5 seconds, there were three or four boys in that class that blurted out their own derogatory remarks to this kid. Why did they do that? Because that coach had just lowered the standard for behavior toward this kid. And once he did it, they piled on. That's what's happening in our text. The Sanhedrin Council has lowered the standard by having this kangaroo court, and all the minions that are there pile on and take advantage of it to beat Jesus. Let me show you another way that that happens. It's not a kangaroo court, but I want you to think about this. In our country, in a talk show like Fox News, people, you know, like Sean Hannity or whoever those all those people are, or something like that, or presidential debates or whatever, I have never heard, and I haven't done a whole lot of listening to them myself anyway, historically, but I've never heard anyone use vulgar language on TV. Until when? 2016. And you know who it was? Trump. All right, President Trump started talking, using foul language publicly. All right, and guess what is now on? Everybody else does it. Ted Cruz, of all people, I've heard him use language like that now. He would not have done before. Why is that? Because the standard has been lowered. Now, that's not a kangaroo court, I understand that. But it's the principle is the same. And we saw President Trump, and I'm not necessarily wanting to badmouth President Trump. I'll be voting for him before I vote for Sleepy Joe, that's for sure. Right? But here's what else President Trump did. Everybody know who Pencil Neck is? Yeah, I can't even remember his name. Hardly. All I know him is Pencil Neck. Adam Schiff. Adam Schiffless. All right. Where'd that come from? Trump. Alfred Newman. Who's Alfred Newman? Who's he referring to when he calls somebody Mark? Alfred Newman. Pete Buttigieg. All right. He looks like him a little bit. Okay. Let me name some more. Pocahontas. Nasty Nancy, Mad Maxine, Crooked Hillary, Little Marco, Low Energy Jeb, Lying Ted, Sleepy Joe, Rocket Man, Orange Man Bad. No, not that one. I don't want to talk about that one. All right. Do you know, I think those things are funny. I do. Now, the ones that are mocking somebody because of their character, I can stomach that a little bit. But to mock someone because of their physical appearance, there's no sense in that. All right? And that's what he's doing to Pencil Neck. Right? However, there's something about Pencil Neck I don't like. I'm convinced he's a liar. I'm convinced he distorted what's right and wrong through the whole 4 years that Trump was president. And what can I do about it? Nothing. There is nothing I can do except one thing. Laugh at his nickname. Mock him. I can do that. Doesn't take a kangaroo court to sink society to a new low. But a kangaroo court is sufficient to do it. The lowest common denominator in our leaders quickly becomes the norm. The next one. Kangaroo courts manufacture the facts needed to support their predetermined conclusion. A kangaroo court, the characteristic of it, or one of them, is that they know what the end result's going to be. They already figured that out. And all they got to do now is figure out how to justify the end. So in our text, but in one of the other Gospels, it said they sought false witnesses to testify against Jesus in order that they might put him, Jesus, to death. All right, now, if I bring up stuff that's not in our text, it's because it's in another gospel. It's not in our text, but it's there. And this is one of those things. They've tried to get false witnesses. Remember, this is the middle of the night. And I doubt if all these people were just at home awake, waiting on somebody to come get them. They find some people that they think they can coordinate their stories in order to lie about Jesus, because remember their law says they've got to have two witnesses. And God forbid that they break their law. So they're trying to get these two witnesses, but they have trouble coordinating their tales. And so they go through them and go through them and go through them until finally they find a pair. Now the proof that they're trying to establish, listen, it is not to make them feel better about what they're doing. How in the world could that make you feel better about what you're doing? Knowing that you have, it only make you feel worse, knowing that you have falsified this report, this witness. The reason they're doing it is to make themselves look better to the people outside this council. Next morning about noon, when all this stuff starts falling apart or starts going to Pilate and to Herod and back to Pilate, and all these kinds of things, and people on the street are saying, hey, what's going on? How did this happen so fast? Well, they have some witnesses. They have everything they need. Forget that they cooked them up. But here they are. And they're having trouble finding them. And part of the reason I think that it probably is because these witnesses have to testify in front of the accused. You've heard the statement that the accused or a person has a right to face their accusers. Right? And that's a good point. If you're going to accuse me of something, you ought to have to do it to my face. Right? And so they are accusing them of Jesus of this, but they got to do it in front of Jesus. And I suspect that at least in some cases, they lose their nerve. they're just a little afraid to go through with it. But finally they find some couple of them, and their great story that they're going to tell about Jesus was back, it's found in John chapter 2, I believe the reference is here, where Jesus, they're standing in front of the temple, and Jesus says, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it." All right, and the Pharisees, or they're standing around there, said, "What are you talking about? It took 46 years to build this temple. You say you can build it back in 3 days?" But the text then tells us that Jesus was not talking about the temple. He was talking about his body. "You destroy this temple, in 3 days I'll raise again." So it's a prediction of the resurrection. Now, Jesus, as far as we know from John chapter 2, didn't explain that to the people. He just said it. And obviously, I think that was intentional. The text also tells us over there that years later, or a few years, 2 or 3 years later, when Jesus was resurrected from the grave, the disciples had an aha moment. They said, "Oh, yeah, we remember when he told us this." Well, here's these two guys. And they're saying, "Yeah, we heard him say one time that you could tear down the temple, the building, and he would build it back in 3 days." Well, that's not what he said to start with. And whatever what he said, it was to be in reference to his own body, not the building. All right? So that was a stretch, but that's the best they had. So they got to go with it. The next one is this. The kangaroo courts avoid witnesses that don't line up with their agenda, no matter how easily accessible they are. All right, this is talked about in one of the Gospels as well. They asked Jesus, "Tell us what you've been teaching." They're trying to get Jesus to incriminate himself. So they asked Jesus, "Tell us what you've been teaching. Who are your disciples? What have you been telling your disciples?" But Jesus isn't talking. Lots of times it says in there he held his peace. He didn't say anything. These people need witnesses. They must have witnesses in order to satisfy their law. They can't just rely on a confession from Jesus. But Jesus finally tells them, "I'll tell you where you can find some witnesses. Every day for the last 2 or 3 years, I've walked the countryside. I've talked to people. You can find any of those people and ask them what I taught. All right? You heard a lot of it yourself. Ask the people what I taught, what I taught." I mean, there's a heretic who you can ask. Ask this guy that was born blind, that I gave him his sight. Matter of fact, you did ask him 2 or 3 times until he got frustrated with you and asked you, "If I tell you again, will you believe it? Try it one more time." Ask him. Ask the leper that I cleansed. Ask Jairus or his daughter. Ask Lazarus, who came from the tomb after 3 or 4 days. Ask the adulterous woman that none of you would lift the first stone to kill. There are a lot of people out there that I've talked to that can tell you what I said. Ask them. And about that time, someone slaps him across the face. Says, "Who in the world do you think you're talking to?" It's a good thing that Jesus didn't ask me what he should do about things. Remember when James and John asked Jesus, "Should we call fire down from heaven and destroy these clowns?" That'd been my favorite trick. All right? They slap him and say, "Do you know who you're talking to?" He said, "Listen, you have heard just what I just said. Show me an error and a falsehood in what I just said. Show me. And if you can't, you don't need to be hitting me. It's unlawful for you to strike me if you can't, if there's not a justifiable reason to do it. The next one, kangaroo courts walk a razor's edge in not disturbing the masses nor blatantly offending the powers that be. This council has a fine line they've got. In fact, they've got to do two things. They've got to find a charge that would fit the Jewish law. Now, blasphemy would do that. If they can convict Jesus of blasphemy in the Jewish court, that's a capital crime. So they could stone him for that. However, they're not allowed to kill people. The Romans have prevented them from exercising capital punishment for executing people. So the Romans, they have to carry him to the Romans to get that accomplished. And the Romans are not going to okay and approve of an execution just because somebody talked bad about the Jewish person's God. They'll say, you got to find something better than this. So they've got to find two things. They've got to find something that will satisfy their own court, but they've got to find something else to satisfy the Romans. We'll be talking about that in the next two or three weeks as well. And then the last one is this. This kangaroo court has bitten off a lot more than it can chew. They ask Jesus, are you the Christ? And Jesus says, if I say yes, you're not going to believe me anyway. And if I were to ask you a question, historically I've asked you questions over the last two or three years, and you never will answer. If I ask you a question, you won't answer me, and you won't let me go. You won't free me from this being arrested here. But he did say this. He says, after this, after what's happening tonight, at some point after that, you're going to see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of God and coming in the clouds in glory. So they say, whoop, I did it. Why do we need other witnesses? I'll tell you why they needed other witnesses. Because their law demanded it of them. He can't be convicted and hung and executed on his own testimony. No matter if they do think it's blasphemy. Can't do it. You've got to have other witnesses. So, they will soon kill him. And they think it's over. We're going to just skip ahead and just think through a little bit here. Is it over? I suspect that Jesus hadn't been in that tomb and the stone rolled in front of it but about 5 minutes. And somebody had a thought. You know, we might ought to put a guard here. You remember him talking about raising from the dead? All that it's going to take is for his disciples to come out here in the middle of the night and roll this thing back and steal his dead body and leave that stone rolled away or maybe close it up, whatever they thought what was best. And this thing is going to be rocking on and rocking on. So they go to Pilate or whoever they went to and said, now we don't believe this was going to happen, but they said he's going to raise from the dead. Can we put a guard there so that we know that his disciples don't steal his body and they claim he was raised from the dead? So they do it. They put a guard there. And the Pharisees and the council at this point begin to remind me of somebody who's got a jack-in-the-box. Did y'all ever have a jack-in-the-box? And you turn the little crank, and all of a sudden it, boom, you know, and the lid pops up. And they're trying to suppress this top, and close that lid down, and hide all this junk that they've been doing. And they're trying to put all this stuff in this box and hide that, push it down and disguise it and hide it so nobody can see what's going on. And somebody says, hey, you know, a day or so later, somebody says, I guess it'd be 3 or 4 days later, that tomb's empty. They said, "Oh, it can't be. Go give those guards $10 and tell them keep your mouth shut." And they stuff it in the jack-in-the-box trying to hide. And somebody comes along and says, "You know, somebody else says they saw him." And they ain't talking about seeing a body. They're talking about seeing him walking around. All right? And somebody else comes along, and perhaps they bring him, some of these people to him, to them, their council. They say, "Well, these two guys were headed from Jerusalem back home. They live at this place called Emmaus, and they meet this stranger on the road and talk to him, and the way he talked was so familiar, and all of a sudden they realize this is Jesus. They're here reporting that they saw him. Stuff it in the box. Put that lid down." And then it's 500 people. That's a lot of stuffing. 500 people have seen him. And the day comes on the day of Pentecost when Jesus had told his disciples to stay in Jerusalem till you be filled with power from on high. The day comes when the Pharisees lose control. No longer can they handle the phoniness of it all. 3,000 people come to Jesus. And then I've got a heading in my Bible that says the next heading for the things after that was the church begins to grow. Sounds like it already started. When did they see him, his glory? Jesus told them, "You may kill me, but you'll see my glory." We look at that 2,000 years after the fact, and if you're like me, every time I see words like that, I think of the second coming. I don't think they were thinking that. I don't think when he told the council that and the Sanhedrin that, they were thinking, "Well, I bet he's talking about the rapture." I don't think so. I think they knew he was talking about something, or figured he was talking about something soon. Something that you will see. But they're not going to live forever. So they think he's talking about something that's going to be pretty soon happening. And they saw it. They didn't like it, but they saw it. This last statement is this: some people just can't keep a secret. That's the way this early church was. They could not keep their mouth shut, could they? Of what God had done. And there are some secrets that just don't need to be kept. That's one of them. I pray that God may help us to never get used to his gift. Pray that God would help us that we may never get used to his grace. I pray that God may help us that we will never get used to his glory. Let's pray.